Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Rogue Startups. I'm your host, Craig Hewitt. This episode, I'm joined by AD Penar, who has been my coach for about 6 months. AD is a three-time now SaaS founder with two successful exits, WooCommerce and WooThemes, acquired by Automattic, and recently Conversio, acquired by Campaign Monitor about a year and a half ago. AD was on this podcast interviewed by Dave about a year ago, year and a half ago, talking about kind of the acquisition and kind of the whole process of building Conversio and it being acquired by Campaign Monitor. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about both my working with AD as a coach, something that a lot of folks have asked me about. It's like, hey, what's it like having a coach? What do you talk about? How do you work together? So talk about that kind of both from my perspective working with him. AD also has a coach, so kind of how he is a student and works with a coach in his business life. And then talking about his new book, Life Profitability, which is all about kind of having balance between your work and life, even though this concept of work-life balance is really something that I think doesn't exist and doesn't apply, but how to have a business that provides for your life so that you can stick with this kind of entrepreneurial journey that we're all on for a long time and be fulfilled in kind of all aspects of your life and have kind of balance there. So without further ado, here's my conversation with AD Penar. Hope you enjoy. AD, how's it going, man?
Hey, Craig. It's really, really nice to be speaking in a different format than what you normally do.
Yeah, for sure. So I think I've mentioned here and like in my kind of email updates to kind of advisors and investors that we've been working together for, gosh, 4, 5, 6 months as like a coaching student relationship. And I get a lot of questions from folks, you know, in Slack and stuff like that about, you know, hey, what's it like to work with a coach? What's AD like to work with a coach? How does that compare to other people out there and Tiny Seed and all this kind of stuff? And so I thought we'd chat through a little bit about that and then want to hear and talk about what you're up to now and why. You've had two kind of successful exits. So kind of why getting back into this new business, and you've just written a book that I want to talk about too. But kind of first, I guess my question is kind of like, why do you choose to coach other entrepreneurs when you have all this other shit going on?
Yeah. And I think the kind of that notion probably starts, and like, correct me if I'm wrong, Craig, because, you know, coaching is one of those things where I'm essentially kind of selling time or committing time, right? And there's very few things that you can do to leverage that, right? And hours spent with a coaching client is an hour spent. So it's unlike kind of, you know, what many of us kind of, you know, aim to do, which is, you know, build a business, you know, get a product, do things that ultimately kind of leverage the kind of our time input, right? So I'm assuming that's where that kind of WTF part of, you know, why would, you know, anyone do this actually comes from. For me, I guess the kind of the big part of this actually goes years back, now that I think of it. I've always been very, very keen to literally pay it forward in any way I can, like especially with young entrepreneurs. And in the past, I especially tried to do that in South Africa. And what I found was maybe I was just inexperienced, or I couldn't get, like, those things never worked out, right? And I would kind of, my takeaway from that was that the kind of mutual commitment wasn't there. Like, I was committing in, you know, to this person, trying to help them out, and then they wouldn't execute, right? And there was a gap there. Mm. So maybe it was just me being totally inexperienced, but I've always had a passion for this. And then what happened kind of, you know, towards the end of my time with Campaign Monitor post-acquisition, Dan Martell, who's been my coach for about 3 years within SaaS Academy, his business has been growing really well. And he asked me to join as a kind of long-time, you know, coaching client of his, asked me to join as a part-time coach. So, which effectively meant, like, you know, 3 or 4 hours a week, I would make myself available to other SaaS Academy founders. I would jump on a coaching call with them and kind of literally help them through, just get some clarity on kind of next actions. And that has been truly fulfilling, because in that sense, there is that structure and I literally just have to show up, right? and I can do this thing. So there's different kind
all of hard stuff taken care of.
Exactly right. And there's, I think, what was great there is, you know, Dan has built SaaS Academy in this whole but kind of very accountable, kind of accountability is a big part of what he does, right? So like the action steps of the work always gets pushed back to the actual client, right? So like we don't do work on the coaching calls, right? The work needs to get done afterwards. The coaching call is just there for clarity, right? So all of that kind of got done. And then like having that structure there, and being able to develop that skill as a coach, like reconnected me to that ultimate kind of passion, which is I just really like helping other entrepreneurs. And like through both my businesses, you know, kind of with Themes WooCommerce as well as Convergio, there's always been this part of me where like the passion is always like, how do I help other businesses? Like that's just a recurring theme. And the coaching has just been, you know, a one-to-one exploration and almost progression or evolution of that, right? So like I don't coach like hundreds of founders or entrepreneurs at this stage because I don't have the time to do that. I wouldn't say exclusive, but I cherry pick those relationships where I feel like I can add value. And I do that also as a way of getting value back, right? Like I do this to learn from others. I do this to kind of, you know, to feel that passion of helping other entrepreneurs, etc. Anyway, that was the long-winded answer, but that's kind of how I got into kind of this, and also why kind of when you approached me a couple of months ago, you know, about the coaching relationship, why like it was a hell yes for me, effectively.
Yeah. And from my perspective, just to kind of give some background, because I don't think I've talked too much about why I chose to have a coach and why I think people in general should have a coach, and I'd love your perspective on this, but the, you know, coming out of the Tiny Seed program, we got a lot of input and feedback and guidance, all in a very positive way, both from the other cohort members and founders, but also from Rob and Einar and you as an advisor there. And frankly, was having some kind of like withdrawal of like, okay, I've been getting all of this communication, especially with COVID and remote world and all this, that I needed, frankly, like more than a mastermind, because I think that's the other kind of option that a lot of folks go into. It's like, oh, I have a mastermind of other people that are about at my level and we can all learn from each other and stuff like that. And that's all good and fine. But for me, I wanted no pressure, but I wanted like the answer. You know, I wanted someone to tell me, Craig, do this, 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 and this. Or at least, Craig, this is the mindset, which is really the kind of level that we talk on. Like, this is the mindset that you need to have to go from A to B. Or these are the people that you need to get in, how to cultivate them to get to the point that you want to get to. And frankly, I think that like, if we look to our peers who kind of by definition haven't gotten to that destination that we all want to get to of, you know, exiting a business or selling a business or having it run on autopilot and making millions of dollars a year, then they're kind of guessing too. Like, I think we all read the blog posts and hear Jason Fried and Andrew Wilkinson and all these guys talk about what they do, and that's all great. But like, to have somebody that really is like, not just one step, but two or three or four steps ahead of you, that is able to tell you really objectively. And like, by definition, our relationship is, I trust you with all of my kind of thoughts and emotions and data of my business, and you entrust in me, like, I think really opinionated perspective of where we are and where we should go. And I have to believe that is hard for you to process that data and then give me back what I really want, which is like an answer or a thing to think about at least that can help me get to where I want to go. I don't know. Does all that resonate with you of like from a student perspective, why this makes sense?
Yeah. So, and I think like there's two things there. Firstly, Craig, that I think is important when anyone thinks about a coaching relationship, right? I think the first thing is like, you should always hire a coach that are further along, like has achieved the thing that you want to achieve here, right? And no coach is like, I don't think, and that's not necessarily like a very broad thing, right? So it's not this, you know, hey, hire someone that's, you know, built kind of a, you know, $1 billion business because that's what I want to do, right? That's possibly too broad, right? But you can totally hire a sales coach. Like if you want to get better at sales, you can hire a sales coach, right? If you want to get better at kind of, you know, running your webinars, like hire a speaking coach, right? So that your articulation or presentation, whatever, is better. So I think that's first, like when you hire a coach, you have to hire someone that's further along, right? And then I think in that sense, the coach is much less, I think, at some point, right? So at some point, it's tactical things. But when you're further along, And I think your business, for example, without sharing figures, you are further along. So you require less tactical things, right? Like, I think a big part of what I also do here is beyond the accountability and things that we discuss, is I think to some extent, I help keep you just, you know, kind of uncomfortable enough, right? Where, like, mm-hmm. in that little bit of tension between, you know, being confident, comfortable, content, and, hey, here's this different way of thinking. Here's this, like, slight stretch goal here, right? And I know that in the coaching relationships that I've had where I've been the student being coached, is that's been of immense value. Because that becomes less of a, hey, Craig, here's my opinion about what you should do next, right? Because I might be wrong. Like, I also don't know your business, your space as well as you do. But I can have that opinion that makes you think twice about that thing that you do next, right? So, which makes you not just sit back on your laurels and kind of rest on your laurels and say, hey, like, I will just go with the default option here. Like, there's probably like two different ways that I can think about this. Are either of those other things, like, do they augment how I think, or should I possibly go down that route? So that's how I think about coaching relationships. I have many kind of peers that have done similar things that I have done, for example, that I learn a hell of a lot on. But those things are more like, hey, here's someone that figured out a really great kind of hiring process, or here's someone that figured out a kind of, you know, some kind of, you know, a unique funnel, especially like it's in my space, so I can probably take those learnings, they figure out what kind of, you know, tech solutions to use. So there's loads of that we can still learn from our peers. And I think a mastermind in that sense is really great. Also on the kind of emotional and mental side, right?
Totally.
But at some sense, yep. I said like that coach really comes, you mentioned mindset and beliefs. I think as leaders of our businesses, that's the thing that mostly needs to get challenged often, right? And you just need someone that, as I think that's where it's important that you find someone that's further along, right? And not necessarily in business, right? I think one of the great things, and I'll call him out, Leo Vidrich, co-founder of Buffer, right? He left Buffer, tells a whole story, and he actually, and this is not to cross-promote my own podcast, but I had him on my podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he shared that journey kind of post-Buffer into the coaching he does now, executive coaching. And it's evident that on the kind of psychological, spiritual level, he is way ahead of me, for example, right? And I can see, like, if that's what I thought I needed right now, Leo would be able to kind of illuminate certain things, right? Mm-hmm. And I think like, that's important. So it's not just, as I said, it's not just as linear and saying, this person has sold a business for X, that's what I want to do, so let's hire them as a coach. I think it can be in any of those things, but the person needs to be further along than what you are on that journey.
Yeah. If you don't mind sharing, and we haven't talked about this before, but how do you work with Dan as a student? Like, how are you coached in that respect? And do you have other kinds of coaches, like these kind of micro subject matter courses, coaches?
Yeah, so no, I don't have other coaches at this stage. I also, like, to some extent, I think it would be hard, like, to have multiple coaches in your ear, right? Like, too many different opinions, like, when, as an entrepreneur already, when you're already making so many different decisions on a daily, weekly basis and need to take all the stimuli into kind of consideration, I think having multiple coaches would be hard. But effectively kind of what kind of the way I work with Dan, at least, is there is a lot of content, i.e. tactical things, and group coaching calls, very, very short. And then we essentially do kind of, you know, quarterly annual reviews, as well as, you know, whenever an exact issue kind of pops up, like I book a half an hour call kind of with them, and we speak only about that kind of issue, very specific structure kind of around that. The last one, for example, that I had was, you know, a couple of months ago, just as I started working on my new thing, Cogsy, and I was thinking through, like, should I self-fund this? Should I kind of, you know, bootstrap, you know, properly and not even self-fund, like, should I raise money? And that's the kind of level of call that I have there, right? So it's more of a kind of, you know, push-pull mechanism there than having, like, a coach with whom I kind of check in on a weekly basis, right? And in saying that, like, I also don't want to be, I don't want to misguide anyone that's in any way kind of interested in SaaS Academy. Like, from when I joined SaaS Academy with Dan 3 years ago, the model has evolved as the kind of the group has grown, right? So a few of those things might be different right now. I would, however, say, like, SaaS Academy has changed, like, changed my life, right? In terms of kind of both, you know, both Dan, the content that, you know, he brings, the coaching I've received, the community and friends I've made, right? Like, I would highly, highly recommend it. But as I said, like, it has changed slightly from when I joined kind of, you know, 3 years ago. Like, for, I mean, one example there being, like, I think we now have 5-6 additional kind of coaches, right? In addition to Dan, right? That's able to jump onto calls to help kind of scale kind of, you know, that, right? So we jump on a call specific format and we're able to use the frameworks, the models, et cetera, that Dan has developed over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a good friend that just joined. I have a couple of friends that are already in it. And yeah, I hear wonderful things about it. It is like this perfect price point of, like, it's not a no-brainer because it is expensive. But yes, I think if your business is at this point, you know, post traction, going to scale where you really could benefit from, like, some of these levers, like Rob talks about, that it's supposed to be a wonderful thing. Frankly, you know, if we weren't working together, I would probably be in SaaS Academy, but I think I get a lot of what I would get out of that from chatting with you, and we're in the same time zone. So it's there's a fair amount of that. And I think just to kind of circle back on masterminds, I absolutely think they're wonderful and valuable. I am in 2. We talk every other week, just like you and I talk every other week. For my 2 masterminds, one is a group of European entrepreneurs, both of which are more successful than me, which is great. The other are 2 founders from the Tiny Seed cohort that were still in a mastermind. We talk every other week and are both very successful there. Both are kind of multi-time founders. And yeah, a lot of that is both kind of like reality check, you know, like, hey, what are you up to? I'm up to this. I'm facing this. I'm struggling with this. A lot of times it's like, whoa, you're crazy, or that's a great idea, but you should think about this. Like, it's really that. You mentioned like different inputs and perspectives. I think those are healthy inputs and perspectives. Like, those are some of the few that I really listen to, because I very much try to filter all this other stuff that I hear online and Twitter and blog posts about. I just filter all that stuff out because I can't handle all that data. But I listen to those very much, and they're very, very valuable to me.
Because it's more contextual, right? Like, that there's a bit, yeah, more of a 360 degree kind of view about who you are as a person. And if, especially if there's familiarity there, like in terms of calling you out, saying, hey, Craig, like, here's something, like, you constantly make, like, when this thing, you know, comes up, you almost kind of check out, or you take the kind of the easier route. Like, what's the kind of bigger challenge here? Like, why do you, mm-hmm, keep not fixing this thing in your business? Right? Like, you keep coming up with these supposed kind of issues here, but it's actually about X, Y, Z, right? And I think, like, to that extent, that's where familiarity kind of helps, right? And that's where, like, I think a mastermind totally helps. I mean, I used to be a EO, Entrepreneurs Organization member, for about 5.5 years, right? And what was fascinating there is I had some great relationships in my forum, which is what we called kind of masterminds. And the group always ranged from about 6 to 8 people at max, right? Depending on, some members kind of cycle out when they don't renew, get new members in. The core group, I think about 5 of us stayed together for a very long time, like 4+ years. And what was great there is, wasn't entrepreneurs in the same space as I, right? The businesses are very, yeah, very varying sizes and whatnot. And again, like, that's just that ability to ask an incisive question because someone is familiar. Like, I'm like, here AD is pitching this, you know, kind of a cash flow issue, right? Where cash flow is not AD's issue, right? AD is just not kind of disciplined elsewhere in his business, right? That's why cash flow is constantly the supposed issue, right? And somebody needs to call AD on the fact that he's not addressing the underlying thing that is causing the cash flow issue, right? Like, AD should not be speaking about, like, how do I, again, bridge this gap and kind of, you know, find this cash flow that I don't have. AD should go back and fix these kind of 2 or 3 things that, you know, puts him in this situation every kind of, you know, 3 to 6 months, whatever the case is. Yep. And I think that only comes with that familiarity and trust and context, whereas you and I can both read, you know, countless books or blog articles, whatever, about fixing cash flow solutions, but they're not super contextual to kind of the challenge that you or I are having as individuals, basically.
Absolutely. Cool. So you were on this podcast, golly, a year and a half ago, when you sold Conversio to Campaign Monitor, and you were at Campaign Monitor for how long?
Just over a year.
Cool. And since then have both written a book and started, are in the process of starting a new business. You mentioned Cogsy. I hear that writing a book is like this tortuous process that like no one in their right mind would willingly go through. Like what's the reason behind writing a book?
Yeah. So interesting enough, and just to kind of to also set expectations here, I'm not that much of an overachiever. Like post, so I left Campaign Monitor September last year, which was, I said, just over a year after we got acquired. And since, like, at that stage, by the way, the book was mostly done, by the way. So I started working on the book just post-acquisition almost as a kind of side project, as a passion project. So the only new thing that I've added post, you know, post leaving Campaign Monitor, at least, is starting to work on Cogsy. It's not like I achieved all of these things in 3 or 4 months. Like, I'm getting old and I don't have that kind of, I don't have 80-hour work weeks in me anymore, right? So just wanted to clarify that, but at least the process of writing a book, so effectively kind of what happened was I started working on a book during Convergio kind of times, and I really wanted, and at that stage I think my goal was to see whether we could self-publish kind of via Convergio, because many of the ideas was a culmination of both my experience in Convergio and kind of some ideas and things that my team and I kind of developed, like more kind of tactical kind of things. So I had this idea for a book, wrote about 35,000 kind of scatterbrained words, you know, for the book, which I had upon then kind of, you know, selling the business. And then what selling the business meant was I suddenly had a bit of extra capital that I could apply. And what I effectively did was I went out and I found a publishing team, a really great kind of multidisciplinary publishing team, to help me turn those ideas into an actual book. Like that's how I would kind of say that. And to that extent, like, it was a really pleasant experience. I mean, I worked, you know, with kind of an editor and writer that, you know, a lady much older than I am, not much older. I estimate that.
You gotta be careful.
Yeah, exactly, right? I think in terms of life experience, like definitely kind of, when I say much older, like I'm probably also saying like 10, 15 years, right? And her experience was not in business. Like she's like classically trained in music, for example. And what was great through that kind of process, and again, like we spoke about that structure and sort of the coaching earlier, what the team essentially did and what Sonia essentially did is they gave me a structure within which I could just bring my best self to the book process. And I didn't need to be a specific type of writer to succeed. I just needed to be myself, because they would cover all the kind of blind spots. They would, again, keep me uncomfortable enough and pull me in the right directions where it needed to go. And I think to that extent, it wasn't only just a pleasant experience writing the book. I also think the kind of the book, the book that is being released, 26 January is the date, is a much better product than I would have been able to kind of self-publish effectively.
That's cool. This reminds me, just as an aside, and I think I mentioned it on the podcast, but you turned me on to the book, Who Not How.
Yes.
Recently. And that reminds me of the concept of that book, which is just like, you as an individual, no matter how much of a rock star you are, cannot achieve the things that a person who is kind of like a micro subject matter expert in this thing and who can own it entirely and only own that thing. Anyways, fantastic book. And that what you just said reminds me so much of that concept, that, you know, hiring this publishing team lets you create a better book faster with less stress than you would have been able to buy yourself. So you spent some money on that. It's an investment in the future. And I think that's the other thing that a lot of people like us that are kind of like not liberated in terms of like our association between time and money completely, because there's always that association. But like when you can truly view like a micro subject matter expert as an investment all the time, I think it's always a positive in the end. And I think, and this is a huge tangent, but like, I think that for me, the struggle with that has been my ability to deliver the things that enable them to be successful, you know, because I think a lot of us say like, I'm going to go find an executive coach, or I'm going to go find a spiritual leader, or I'm going to go find a copywriter, or I'm going to go find a publishing team. And you do that, but then you still hold on to it and you baby them. Yes. And you do all this shit that like confines them from owning this thing and running with it and being successful. So anyway, that's a huge tangent. But so Life Profitability is both the name of your podcast and of the book, January 26th coming out. I've read kind of a fair part of the kind of advanced copy of the book. And I will paraphrase the concept a little bit, which is kind of, and you can kind of correct me and get back on the talking tracks from there. But the concept really is like, we all have this idea of like the arrival fallacy of like, when I get to $10 million a year, or when I exit my business, or when I, you know, become an angel investor instead of, you know, writing marketing emails, then my life will be why. And I think that like, what I'm getting out of the book is like, for a lot of us, that will just never happen. And so like, we have to take the time and be intentional now to have kind of like, as you put it, our business provide life profits, like these things that return positive things back to our personal and family lives as we go, so that we cannot get burned out and continue on this journey for a long time. Is that like in the ballpark of kind of where you would position the book?
Yeah. So, and I think that there's, you know, there's really kind of two broad concepts, you know, concepts that just kind of builds out on that, right? I think the first thing that I, you know, really try and break down with the book is this notion of work-life balance, right? Where we're trying to say that, you know, because work-life balance is such a, in the mainstream, like it's still a thing that so many people kind of, you know, aspire to. And so few people manage it, right? And I didn't, like, even people I think say, sure, I've got kind of work-life balance figured out. I would love for them to explain how they can actually even do this. And the reason I say that is, you know, work-life balance proposes at least that, you know, work and life are two independent things and they can thus keep each other in balance. And I don't think it's that, right? I think like work is just part of life. Life is this bigger thing and work just fits into that alongside anything else, right? Whether it's a hobby, a passion project, whether it's, you know, practicing a sport, whether it's family, whether it's friends, like all of those other things are just part of life. And those, all of those things need to be in balance with work, not with life, right? Life is just this ultimate container, right? So I think that's, you know, a big core concept in life profitability. And crucially, kind of why I think that is important is you've mentioned this kind of, you know, if I achieve X, then kind of Y will be true kind of thing is, I think there's such a big risk in sequencing important life events or things, right? In the sense that even if I was the best entrepreneur in the world in this moment, and I had that idea of like, if I do X, then Y is the goal and I'm going to achieve Y. So I see the rainbow and I see the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The reality is I'm not guaranteed of that outcome, right? It doesn't matter how well I execute. That outcome is just not that guaranteed. But crucially, the part that I think is much, much riskier is we A, don't know how much time we need to get to that outcome, right? And B, as mortal beings, we don't know how much time we'll have, right? And I think like those things, when I've looked at myself, and this is a big part of, as I got into building out this concept of life profitability with my team in the last, you know, what it was 15 months of getting the book ready for market, was really acknowledging at how many stages of my life I thought 80 as the entrepreneur, i.e. my business is the number one thing that I needed to do. And I didn't consider what I now call kind of the life costs or life losses, like all of that collateral damages that are kind of strewn across the kind of this journey that I've had until kind of business success, right? And crucially, kind of what many people don't know, yes, Convergio had a fairy tale kind of ending, life-changing exit, right? But halfway through that journey, I almost lost everything that was important in my life. Like I burnt out, I screwed up, like everything kind of, like literally was kind of that bucket that just kept getting water and like eventually could not take anymore. And I think that's what we don't realize when we think about businesses or just building profitable businesses. So with the book, I'm literally just trying to shift the narrative here. Not saying that financial profit is like not desirable or good. I'm just saying you have to build a business that works for you. You have to build a business that is actually profitable for your life and not just profitable in this very narrow sense, in the sense that you're kind of a business, your bank account or your personal bank account grows, right? There's this, and I'll stop the monologue after this. There's the kind of this great quote that I found in a also found, but that doesn't matter, roundabout way in which I found it, but it's an Argentinian philosopher, and he essentially said, like, you know, those people that trade their time for money can never again trade money for happiness, right? And like that, okay. if I add on top of that, like Henry Thoreau, like when he wrote Walden all those years ago, and as philosopher, like he wrote, the cost of doing anything in life is life, right? We have finite kind of, you know, energy, attention, time span, all those things. And just changing that narrative to saying, like, doesn't help if I have this huge bank balance and I don't know how to actually use that money to be happy. Because money itself in a bank does not, like, I've not heard anyone ever say, like, I am incredibly happy, stable, calm, peaceful, and, you know, fulfilled individual just because I have X amount of money in the bank.
How do you kind of balance that when you're talking to folks, or are you personally, with, you know, a lot of us are, you know, we were talking before we started of like entrepreneurs kind of started this, like they're doing all the work, you know, all the marketing, all the development, all the this, all the hiring, making sure there's money in the bank too, kind of the other end of the spectrum. We talked about Dan Martell. Like, I think he's at like a CEO level where all he does is recruit people, run the high level vision and stuff. For me, when I look at this concept of prioritizing your personal life and life profitability, is that that's just a lot easier to do when you get further towards the CEO level on the spectrum, because you have, I don't know. I want to say more time, but I'm sure that's not the case, that like those super successful people don't have more time. But just say, let's just say, like, for this person who's just getting started and they're hustling to get their first 10 customers and stuff, how do you, from like a practical perspective, say like, yeah, I know that this is important. I know you want to, you know, grow your business and stuff, but you also have to like take care of yourself and make those considerations. Cause I think it's easy to say, yeah, I got to take care of myself and kind of have my business provide for me and my family, but maybe tougher to do, especially early on.
Yeah. And 100% right. And I think I want to acknowledge there that, you know, me writing this book does not propose that I've got all of it figured out, right? And that I had all of this figured out in the past. And I think to that point, Craig, I think there are seasons in kind of one's life and business as well where things get out of whack a little bit. So like my take on that, I think, is firstly this notion of like truly just acknowledging and knowing who you are, like in this moment, right? And like and having that clarity and making sure that whatever you do next needs to be in alignment with that, right? So, I mean, you mentioned this kind of, you know, if I do X, then Y appears and that's desirable. What most people don't understand is if you're not clear about who you are today as an entrepreneur and you're hustling to get the first 10 customers because that's going to give you something else, you're likely also not going to be in alignment with yourself after that because you don't have the vocabulary or awareness of what that means. I think the irony in that is, there's only a single common denominator on like each of our journeys. Like there's only a single common denominator on my journey going forward. And that's me, right? Like my family can change. I can get divorced, right? I can move to a different country. Like I can make new friends. The business can change. My team members can change. Like everything can change, but I'm still going to be on that journey. So like, I think that's like in terms of figuring out how to take steps that helps you build greater kind of life profitability into your life, you have to be in alignment with yourself. And I think part of that alignment is then really just looking at your values, right? Like, what do you value in life? And I think few people will really say, like, the only thing I value is success in my business, right? And just then making sure that, hey, here's this full kind of map almost. And the way I like to look at it is same as a kind of your investment portfolio. Like, have your life portfolio and make sure that it's diversified, right? And that you are making the necessary investments in each of those components, right? As I said, like whether that's family or friends, whether it's hobbies, like it just like should not be only business, right? I think that having that awareness and making sure that you say, I don't necessarily say track, but like at least monitor your own, like when you, like I like the idea of tripwires, for example, right? Like I've built multiple kind of disciplines and habits into my life that are tripwires that as soon as I veer off, because don't get me wrong, I'm incredibly ambitious. And if I'm allowed the time, I will probably work more than what is good for my own life profitability, right? But I know I have, at least have those tripwires to then bring me back to a space where, you know what, like, I don't have to push this hard in the business. Like, I can delay this project by 2 weeks without materially changing anything in my business, but doing that creates space to kind of reinvest elsewhere in my life portfolio, elsewhere where there's also kind of an urgent or important need in this moment.
Like really kind of practically, are there kind of tools or systems or ways that you kind of keep yourself accountable and kind of have those tripwires?
Yeah. So, I mean, I get like, I think, you know, the most obvious ones for me is literally just listening to the people around me that matter most, right? So, I mean, I think two examples that I have is, you know, Jean, my wife, like, you know, she has a great ability to be able to just ask me kind of a simple question, like, hey, like, you've snapped at the kids like twice today. Like, what's up? Like, is something bothering you, right? And that's the kind of, on the surface, that's the kind of question, especially from a spouse, when you're really irritated, probably gets like, oh, like, should I really be having this conversation?
You don't know.
But,
yeah.
Exactly, right? But now I what I've learned is if I stay curious in that moment for even a second, I'm probably able to then tell her, like, oh, you know what? This thing that's been ongoing in the business, I've not been able to figure out, and it's just like, it's just grating me, right? So that kind of tripwire. The other thing I did, like, in terms of people there is Devet, he's both my best friend. He was also 2IC for me and Convergio. And having someone in the business, like, again, like, this is very much against, you know, popular kind of, you know, business kind of advice here, like, don't work with friends, right? But having him there and having him almost straddle both those worlds in terms of business and who I am as an individual, again, like, having that having a third party that has slightly different perspective is truly helpful, right? So I've done it with people. I also just do it by kind of, you know, journaling in the mornings, right? And I don't journal every single morning, but I try and journal as often as I kind of remember and, you know, kind of make the time to do that, because that gets the stuff out of my head, for example. And like, when I read it back, then I can see some patterns emerge. And I'm like, oh, like 2-3 weeks ago there, like, this thing was chasing me and I went down a tangent path that I probably should not have, right? And I think the, you know, a lot of this and the undercurrent of this is, you know, a big part and one of the things that I mentioned in the book often, and I didn't want to write a book about meditation or mindfulness or any of those things, but mindfulness played a big part in how I ultimately resurrected parts of my life. I mean, I mentioned earlier, a couple of years ago when things fell apart, worked with a therapist that got me into mindfulness that helped me understand where my mind was on fire and where I was constantly in fight or flight mode, and how that was a great thing when you want to make progress on certain things, and how there was a, you know, totally subpar solution for so many other things, right? And I think the key notion of mindfulness and thus awareness is just, it's never about being perfect. It's always just about, as soon as possible, acknowledging that something is off or something is there. So it doesn't even have to be, no judgment, right? Just acknowledging something is there, right? So like, the more practices that I can build into my life that floats those things up sooner, and where I've kind of allowed myself to see those things, like, I've been able to essentially course correct from there.
Do you, speaking of mindfulness, do you kind of meditate, or do you have kind of an active practice around this to kind of encourage mindfulness?
Yeah. So initially when I started out, on mindfulness, like, I think for the first year, I went on a streak, not missing a single day of meditated, you know, I got to about, you know, ultimately worked it up to about 20 minutes a day in the mornings. Mm. And then since then, like, I still meditate. I now do so more ad hoc. I've also learned to kind of meditate whilst running, and I won't have any kind of music in my ear. And I just have this thing where I follow kind of, and I actually count my footsteps, every second one at least. I can't count that fast. I'm also not the faster runner. So I still do those things now more than the kind of ad hoc thing. Like, the meditation is ultimately, I think, the same way as you would go to the gym to make your bicep bigger, meditation is just a kind of a muscle, like, it uses, it's a exercise to increase the muscle of mindfulness effectively, right? So, yeah, so I don't do it as kind of rigorously or kind of irregularly as I used to in the past.
Cool. It's one of my ambitions or kind of goals for this year is to get better at it. I use Headspace on my phone for some guided meditation. I understand they have a Netflix show or channel or something like that, that I heard from a friend this weekend. I'll be checking it out. So kind of getting back to kind of the concept of life profitability, you know, one of the things that strikes me the most and is most impactful to me is this kind of idea of longevity in this kind of part of our professional life, right? I think a lot of us, back to the arrival fallacy of like, there will be an end to this, you know, that like, I'll build my business and either it'll just cash flow and provide a bunch of money and I'll go kind of fuck off and go skiing 5 days a week, you know, or I'll sell the business and then I'll, you know, something about my life will change significantly. And I think that like, that was very much my mindset before, was that there will be something that happens to where my life will all of a sudden be magical and there'll be, you know, rainbows and unicorns everywhere. And I'm realizing now that like, one, I don't want that to happen necessarily because I really enjoy working and I really get a lot out of it. And maybe it's that I'm like fortunate enough to be doing mostly the things I want to be doing at work. I think a lot of us have the ability to do that more than we think. But I also kind of realized that like, I would really be lost without this as like a sense of purpose, that like my family is super important to me, my wife and my kids and, you know, our extended family and stuff like that, super important to me, but also like my sense of worth comes a lot from the achievements that I have at work. And one of the scariest things is like just not being able to do this anymore for whatever reason, whether it's bad, like, you know, I get sick and I can't work, or in a weird way, like I'm successful and I can't keep doing this anymore, or I burn out and I don't want to do this anymore. So like when I was reading the book, like that's one of the things that I thought a lot about was like, I have to, you know, it's not work-life balance, but I have to be in a situation where I can continue running my business at a high level like I want to, but also be fulfilled in my personal life or my life as a whole to where I can just keep doing this for a long time because I don't want to, you know, quote, retire. I don't want to stop doing this stuff. And so having that balance in my life is like a big driver of the, I don't know, from a time perspective, I guess. Does that kind of resonate at all?
Entirely right. And I think like, you know, what you're describing there, in my opinion, is life profitability, right? And like what you ultimately put into that kind of life portfolio of yours, like that will evolve and change over time, right? Like you sell a business and you decide like you suddenly have like one thing that kind of gets added to that life portfolio at that stage is hopefully a whole bunch of cash, right? But then you need to decide like, how do I reuse this cash and rebalance that portfolio again, right? So all of that is just life profitability. And I don't think that there's a single definition of our own kind of life profitability today that stays consistent forever, right? Like as I said, like I think that evolves with time, like across kind of multiple, you know, business successes, right? I mean, I know for me, for example, like post Convergio, I could have retired, right? Like I could have invested the money and I would probably, I would not have needed to work again, right? Unless my investment managers made kind of gross errors in how they allocated my funds, right? I would not have had to work again. I also decided to start kind of a new SaaS business because that's still a big part of me, right? There's still things that I want to do there because that's my version of life profitability, right? Same thing with writing this book. The book and everything I'm doing with the book at the moment, like it requires a big investment, but it's important for me to get this message out there. And hopefully it can obviously really resonates. That's less important, right? Or that's secondary at least. The first part of this was I needed to do the work to get this book and this idea out in the world because I truly believe in it. And it's like, again, that's my version of life profitability, right? So as I said, I think there are, that yes, right? Like for some people, you know, their version of life profitability might be like, listen, you know, I want to sell my business in 10 years, even if I'm only kind of, you know, say 40 at the time. And I want to retire and I want to whatever, right? That's perfectly fine. Like, I don't think like any of that, like there's no right or wrong there. And like, I think what I didn't mention before is like the book that I wrote, right? Life Profitability, The New Measure of Entrepreneurial Success. I purposely did not want to write a how-to book because I don't believe in blueprints. I don't believe that you can write like a perfect blueprint that is just going to apply to everyone else. The book is there, and there's worksheets, there's guidance like for you to help figure out what life profitability means for you. But it's a totally unique, personalized thing, right? And I said, like, for some people, that's perfectly okay if they want to retire and ski 5 days a week. That's not for me, right? Like, at this stage, at least, right? Maybe that changes. Maybe I fail spectacularly in this next business, and I'm like, okay, you know, all done. Like, you know, not doing this again. This is way too hard. These things can change. But that's, again, like, that's why I speak about that awareness and making sure that kind of where, like, as we pursue these life profits, like, just always remembering, like, where are we also just creating life costs, right? And making sure that net literally nets out to life profitability.
Can you talk a little bit about what you're up to now with Cogsy?
Yeah, so Cogsy, and again, I think for people that also saw, like, why the hell would 80 build a new SaaS? I think the one thing I learned, and I considered as a slight kind of sign, I considered other paths before I went down Cogsy. I considered, like, just building out my coaching business. I considered, like, doubling down the book, and kind of, you know, becoming a keynote speaker, that kind of thing, like selling information, essentially, workshopping, all of those things, had opportunities to do so as well. And the reason I ultimately decided to build a new SaaS business is I really wanted to build a team again. Because I really missed that. Like, you know, post, like, leaving Campaign Monitor, leaving my team there, like, that's what I really, 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 like, I realized, like, I really missed that. So Cogsy stays in the same space as I've always been, you know, building. And the product itself is still liquid. The idea is that we build a product that helps e-commerce brands optimize their working capital, and specifically around inventory. So that's the space we're entering. So sticking within kind of SaaS for e-commerce, something that I know well. And depending on exactly when this airs, kind of Cogsy V1 should be in the hands of a few early kind of adopting paying customers as well. So that's what I've been working on for the last, like, the two main things that I've been working on the last two, three months, has been recruiting the initial team, building the kind of, and building the first version with an outsourced agency whilst I can recruit the team, so that I can put it into kind of the hands of some early customers as quickly as possible.
That's cool. That's cool. I think we'll have to have a whole nother episode in, I don't know, like 6 months or so, about kind of what that process looked like. I know you raised a little bit of money to do that. So kind of that whole decision of, like, you know, why raise money versus you could self-fund it, surely. The agency rolling it out, and especially, like, third time around, you know, like, what did you do more right this time that you screwed up before? So I think it'd be fun to have another follow-up episode in a few months about kind of, like, looking back now, third time around, you know, is it easier? What did you screw up again that you never thought you would mess up again? Those kind of things. So,
and by the way, Craig, just on that point, like, I went into conversion thinking it was going to be easier. I don't think, you know, every subsequent business, I don't think it gets easier. I just think it gets different.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. I mean, even, like, kind of where I am now versus a year ago, right? It's not easier. It's just different kind of problems that we're tackling every day. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. 80, this is a lot of fun. For folks who want to kind of check out more about you and the book and the podcast, where's the best place?
Yeah, so best place is probably, like, the hub here is my personal website, 80ii.me. And if you go to 80ii.me/book, the book is there. And the book is also available on Amazon primarily, as well as most other kind of, you know, popular book sellers online.
Cool. Awesome. 80, thanks so much for chatting. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.